From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. Madeline Brand's away. I'm Alex Chadwick. Coming up, Senator Obama goes to Iraq. We'll have the view from Washington with Juan Williams on political developments. We'll begin today, though, with money and the story of woe all week. Recall this statistic from yesterday. 1 million home foreclosures expected by the end of this year. There's also the huge drop in property values around the country. Many families are hurt, many communities too. After all, lower property values mean lower property tax revenues. That's what a lot of local governments live on. In southern Nevada, Clark County, that's Las Vegas, has been especially hard hit. With us now from Las Vegas, Clark County Commission Chairman Rory Reed. Rory, welcome to Day to Day. How heavily does this affect life there in Las Vegas? For your county government, you run a lot of services there. What's going on with your revenue?
It is not a good story. We've struggled. Our receipts aren't what they used to be. We're reliant to a very significant degree on sales tax and property tax, and at least in terms of sales tax receipts, they're down over last year, and we've had to be more creative about the way we govern. It's interesting. When a business has hard times, Alex, business goes down. When a government is subject to the same economic condition, business goes up.
Right. There are more demands on services. People need more from you.
Right. We've had a 35% increase in social service requests. We're having to decide what we need to do and set aside those things that we might want to do to a later day.
Here's a question that applies, I think, in probably every county like yours all across the country. You set property tax rates by some percentage of the valuation of the property.
Right.
You can't just tick that up a couple of notches or three or four notches because you need the money.
We can't, and we're a subdivision of the state government, and the state has capped property taxes. Sales tax receipts are down significantly, and we're feeling that very immediately, but the adjustment in real estate values really hasn't hit us yet. Property tax receipts are not down yet because we've had such increases in valuation that we haven't felt the downturn yet in terms of property tax receipts.
But you have seen property values go down.
Oh, in a very significant way.
So you've got to expect that at some point the tax revenues are going to follow, right?
Oh, sure. It's a delayed reaction, and we're trying to plan for that and make very difficult decisions. We have in Clark County nearly 400 positions that we have not filled.
What kinds of positions are you talking about?
Anything you can imagine that a government does. Parks and recreation kinds of services and the things that typically people expect to be provided by their local government, we've made cuts. Now, we're making sure we provide essential services like ambulance drivers and all the kinds of things that we do with respect to public safety. But a lot of our capital projects, community centers, those kinds of things have been delayed because we just can't afford to do it now.
Do you have people calling you up saying, I want a reassessment right now because my neighbor's property just sold for $100,000 less than I bought my place for, and I'm paying too much in taxes?
When our assessor is about to put out the property tax bills, he gives us a courtesy call letting us know the calls are going to start here soon, and he's usually right. And, I can understand people have been sitting in their property, the single largest investment they make in their lifetime. They watch that value diminish, but their property tax doesn't fall as quickly. And we're being challenged by the economic forces that we can't control. I think, though, that we'll be resilient and we'll get through it. We don't have any choice.
Rory Reed, he's chairman of the Clark County Commission. That's where Las Vegas is in southern Nevada. Rory, thank you, and good luck there.
Thank you, Alex.
Like Nevada, California has also seen property values plummet over the past year, about 30% in just 12 months. But unlike Nevada, California officials are not too worried about a looming collapse in property tax revenues, and that's because of Proposition 13, passed by angry voters 30 years ago. It limited the growth of property taxes, but it's also meant stability in hard times. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports it also has meant stability for some property owners.
Jo Ramsey is showing me through her spacious hillside home in Los Angeles's View Park neighborhood.
This is a Cape Cod, 4 bedrooms, 3 baths, family room, former dining room, kitchen, TV room.
The living room with its grand piano and gleaming hardwood floors looks out on another amenity she forgot to mention.
Oh, the backyard is gorgeous.
And you've got
a swimming pool.
We got a black bottom swimming pool.
Ramsey, a semi-retired real estate agent, and her husband Wade, a retired school administrator, bought their home in 1976. That was 2 years before the tax revolt spurred by the late Howard Jarvis, a Republican activist, put a cap on the state's real estate taxes. Sitting in her wood-paneled den, Jo Ramsey tells me Prop 13 has been a lifesaver for the state's homeowners.
You look at the rest of the country and what those prices are, what those taxes are killing people.
Jo recalls hearing from a friend who relocated to Houston a few years ago in search of more reasonable real estate.
She called me. I moved to Texas. I got a 3,900 square foot house, and I only paid $200,000 for it. Guess how much her taxes are? $9,500 a year, and she wants to sell it again.
The Ramseys paid $69,000 for their two-story home in 1976. They upgraded with the pool and added solar paneling in the mid-80s. Not long ago, someone offered them $1.2 million for it. Unlike her Texas friend, Jo and her husband pay well under $2,000 in annual property taxes. Critics claim that very comfortable tax rate comes at the cost of support for local municipal staples like public schools, the police, and fire departments. But historian and urbanologist Joel Kotkin says we have to remember the context in which Prop 13 was birthed. In the late 70s, soaring home prices and rapidly rising property taxes were starting to force many Californians out of their homes, especially those who were elderly or on fixed incomes. Kotkin says Jarvis's Proposition 13 struck a chord in angry, anxious homeowners.
California had prided itself on a fair tax system. That it was not fair for some working-class person who had bought a house for $8,000 in 1946 was suddenly paying three times that in property taxes.
So those people were able to keep their homes, but that had an unintended effect. There's been so little turnover in many areas that many first-time would-be homebuyers have been frozen out of the market. Jack Kaiser, chief economist for the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation, says Prop 13 is an imperfect fiscal compromise, but is proving to be a big help in the current real estate downturn because while home prices plummet in some areas, property taxes don't.
Prop 13 is a strange thing. A lot of people feel it caused a lot of problems with local government finance, but in times like these, is providing a little bit of stabilization.
Joel Kotkin admits the economic trade-offs are complicated, but he says it pays to remember that single-family home ownership remains a magnetic part of the California dream, pulling people from less hospitable parts of the country.
What's the point of living in California without having the ability to look at the sun and to be outside, to sit outside and have a barbecue? I mean, if you take that away, why be here?
Homeowners like Jo Ramsey say Prop 13 has enabled them to pursue that dream, and she is happy with it as it is.
Very. And anybody else that's gotten a sense is going to be happy with Prop 13.
Wherever he is, Howard Jarvis is probably nodding in satisfaction. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Senator Barack Obama is headed overseas. His campaign has not released an itinerary. It's keeping quiet on details. What is known is he's going to make a swing through Europe and the Middle East. And maybe the worst-kept secret of this trip, he's going to stop in Iraq and Afghanistan. Joining us, NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Juan, this trip's getting a lot of attention. That's good for Senator Obama, but maybe there are some pitfalls here as well.
Well, the big pitfall is how it plays back at home. You don't know how voters in the middle of the country are going to react if he is greeted, as is being anticipated, with Obama-palooza-type enthusiasm through Europe. Obviously, if this election was being held in the countries he's visiting, places like Germany, France, and England, I don't think there's any question Barack Obama would be a runaway winner. But the other part of this, Alex, that you have to contend with is this is the first time that he's been in Iraq since January of 06, and it's the first time ever that he's going to Afghanistan. Does the trip become a media circus, a media event? We got all three anchors trailing after him. It's not just the press corps. And does he have time to really do an assessment of the situation on the ground as opposed to simply creating photo ops that make soldiers and commanders into props? That could hurt Barack Obama.
You mentioned the three TV anchors, 200 reporters following along on the press plane. That's a heck of a tail to drag behind you, isn't it?
It is, and it stands in stark contrast to the people who accompanied John McCain. He didn't get anywhere near that coverage when he went over there, and so already his campaign is saying, you know what, this isn't a serious event.
Two big polls out in the last couple of days show Senator Obama with his biggest lead yet over Senator McCain, but also some vulnerabilities.
Yeah, real vulnerabilities on, I would say, two key points, Alex. One is to be commander-in-chief, John McCain holds a 24-point lead. That's a pretty strong margin. And similarly, when it comes to an issue of level of experience that would allow him to be president, again, you see McCain, 49% say McCain has that level of experience. But, you know, what strikes me about this is that Barack Obama is maintaining a lead about 6 to 8 points. But the bigger problem for Barack Obama is he should be doing much better because a generic Democrat runs about 20 points ahead of a generic Republican. Somehow John McCain is managing to hang in there, hang around. It's like a basketball game. The visiting team hanging around, and you never know what's going to happen at the end.
Right, yeah. So this week, two interesting political forums, the NAACP and La Raza, both held annual conventions, and both candidates spoke at them. They got very different receptions. And you were at that La Raza convention where, I may note, you won a big journalism award. But what did you see there?
Well, what was interesting to me was I saw part of the McCain event, and afterwards, in talking to people, they said, you know, McCain did very well. Remember, about two-thirds of Latinos right now favored Barack Obama, according to the polls, and Barack Obama had been there and had been given a grand reception, but people said he kind of fell flat in terms of the delivery. And here's the key, Alex, from the political point of view. He didn't spend time taking the picture, shaking the hands, or taking questions. Senator McCain, on the other hand, did all of that, and in the question and answer, really got the crowd going so that the crowd gave him a standing ovation. I think that was unpredictable. People didn't think that was going to happen. And I hear that with such regret from people who are Barack Obama supporters. They say, you know, you can't take it for granted. You can't run out the clock. And McCain seems to be working it better with crowds. I also heard that from the NAACP officials who said that McCain's people were easier to work with and McCain spent more time.
Well, I'm going to call those your best political conversations of the week. NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Juan, thank you again.
Take care, Alex.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick. Madeline Brand is away, but she left the third and final part of her interview with Jane Mayer about Jane's new book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Yesterday, Jane explained that she thinks the administration's interrogation policy and other extraordinary measures can be traced to Vice President Dick Cheney and his staff. Today's part of the interview begins with a question about what's known as rendition, capturing suspected terrorists wherever they are and then flying them around the world to secret prisons. Madeline asked Jane Mayer whether she thinks rendition is still taking place.
The policy is still on the books, the programs are still on the books, but whether they're actively being used at this moment, it seems to me doubtful because of the amount of controversy they've stirred now.
But yet we still don't know how many people were taken to these black sites, nor do we know really what happened to them.
No, I mean, and as a journalist and somebody who's been trying to cover this story for a couple of years now, I think that one of the most valuable things that could happen in the political debate and or with during this election year and maybe with the next president and next attorney general would be just trying to get the facts of this story. You know, I tried to get as many as I could in this book, and there's some phenomenal stories that you can already put together, but there are great gaps still. And in some ways, I think it's going to take someone with a subpoena. For instance, members of Congress need to really kind of get involved, and it probably takes somebody with national security clearances so that they can really make independent judgments about whether or not these documents need to be hidden, because tremendous quantities of these documents have been held back from the public.
Jane, it's not just enhanced interrogation techniques or whatever you want to call them and these black sites that are part of your book, but you also talk about the Terrorist Surveillance Program, or TSP. And there was an extraordinary debate within the Justice Department over this program. Now, we've just revisited this with the debate over the wiretapping legislation in Congress. Now, take us back to when this was being debated within the administration and before any of us had even heard about it or knew that this program was in place.
Well, this is in 2004, and what's going on inside the White House is there was a parallel process both for terrorist surveillance programs and for torture. What happened was there were a number of lawyers who really had sort of crises of conscience inside the Bush administration. You know, there were a number of people who I think showed tremendous courage and who I really came to admire for what they did, because they basically said, we're not going to break the laws here. We're going to keep the country inside the rule of law. And some of these programs simply are not legal. We cannot condone them. And that happened with the terrorist surveillance program. It also happened with the torture program. And the lawyers that stood up for the rule of law in this, are some of them have been known before, Jack Goldsmith, for instance, but there's a lot more about his struggle in here. And another is a lawyer named Dan Levin, who actually went to such lengths to try to figure out really what was torture and what's not torture that he wound up waterboarding himself, or having himself waterboarded, and also putting himself through other forms of sort of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. But at any rate, they tried to stop these practices, which they saw as not lawful. And they came into direct conflict with top people in the White House, in particular with Cheney, with Addington, with Gonzalez, who tried to ram it through anyway. And there is a famous scene that's been written about a lot about when John Ashcroft became very ill and was in the hospital and transferred his powers to Jim Comey, who was his deputy. And it was right at that moment that the top people in the White House tried to get Ashcroft, even though he was seen to be almost on his deathbed, to sign on to these programs, because some of the lawyers around Ashcroft thought that the president, vice president, and the attorney general and the White House counsel were trying to take advantage of him in his diminished state to push through something that they really thought was not legal.
So they raced to his bedside in the middle of the night in a hospital, and James Comey gets there first and tells him not to sign this piece of legislation.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the things that happen inside the Bush administration were like things that you see in thriller novels, really. And some of the characters were equally good and strong. I think people who are cynical about Washington would be surprised to see the lengths that some of the lawyers inside this administration and some of the FBI officers and some of the military officers, actually, too, went to stand up for the rule of law.
And then after that incident, though, remarkably, James Comey is so paranoid that he thinks he's being wiretapped.
This is, I think, a wonderful illustration of what the atmosphere was like in there. It became so intimidating. At a certain point, the people who opposed Cheney and Addington felt that they were going to face terrible retaliation. And as you say, at one point, Comey, the number two person at the Justice Department, and Jack Goldsmith, who ran the Office of Legal Counsel, a terrifically powerful office there, were trying to withdraw some of these memos that they saw as flawed. And they knew they were going to get such flack from Cheney and his lawyer that they were afraid that they were either in physical danger or maybe being wiretapped. And so they started talking in codes to each other. The upshot was that Goldsmith managed to withdraw the memo, but felt he had to quit almost on the spot.
Well, a lot of these renegades, as you say, did have to quit or did leave the White House, leave the administration. James Comey's no longer there. Neither is Jack Goldsmith. Many of them left.
It's one of the sad things about this is that many, many good people, Republican, Democrat, nonpartisan people, the experts, again, in the FBI in particular, most of the people who really clashed on the idea of torture got driven out, and they took great expertise with them. You know, at the end of the day, I wound up talking to a historian named Philip Zelikow, who was the counselor to Condoleezza Rice. So he's a Republican lawyer. He was also the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. And I was trying to get his perspective on all this. He, too, has left the government by this point. And he basically said he thinks that this whole period and the use of torture by the United States will be seen as a blot sort of similar to the Japanese internment during World War II by FDR. And he said that he thought it happened for many of the same reasons and in much the same way. And basically, he said, and I thought it was just an astounding quote from someone who was actually part of this administration at one point. He said, "Fear and anxiety were exploited by zealots and fools."
Jane Mayer, thank you very much.
So great to be with you. Thanks a lot for having me.
That's New Yorker writer Jane Mayer. She has a new book out. It's just published this week. It's called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals.
You can hear the other two parts of Madeline's interview at NPR.org. Each day we've run this interview, we have asked the White House to comment on Jane Mayer's book, and the White House has not responded. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick. Coming up, the New York City food fight over posting calories. Are you really going to pass on the pretzels when you know what they do to your diet? First, we've invited NPR diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster back on the show today to explain what's happening with one of the most sensitive foreign policy problems for the U.S., and that is Iran. Mike, welcome.
Hi, Alex.
Tomorrow in Geneva, something is happening that I think is unprecedented for the Bush administration, an actual high-level meeting with Iranians. What is this?
It is unprecedented in that a high-level U.S. diplomat, William Burns, the number three diplomat at the State Department, will join European talks with the Iranians in Geneva. What's not unprecedented about this is that these talks have been going on for 4 years. The Europeans have been trying to negotiate away the Iranian nuclear threat in their mind for 4 years. The United States has been backing these talks for the last 2 years, but has not sent a significant diplomat to participate in them. And it's been the Bush administration's policy up till this week to let the Europeans do it. Now, this week, the Bush administration says that William Burns can participate, but only this one time, and these are not negotiations.
It's not just that they didn't send Mr. Burns. It's they said, we will not talk to any Iranian until the Iranians absolutely stop enriching uranium and swear that they'll never do it again because that will lead to a bomb.
Exactly. That's what Secretary of State Rice has been saying all along. She's said she is willing to meet with her counterpart, the foreign minister of Iran, any place, anytime, as long as Iran first suspends its uranium enrichment. What has been strange about this is that the goal, that one of the primary goals of any negotiation with Iran would be to get them to stop enriching uranium. So in effect, the Bush administration has put the end before the beginning in order to avoid talking with Iran. Now it seems at least they've come to the conclusion that a U.S. diplomat ought to be in the room when this is discussed.
Do you know why this is happening? And I must say it's happening in the context of a campaign year when Senator Obama, the Democrat, has made quite a point of saying, I would talk to Iran, and he's been criticized heavily for it.
All the signs point to Secretary of State Rice as the driver on this. That she has looked at the North Korea talks that have taken place over the last couple of years, where initially the United States said it would participate multilaterally, but it wouldn't talk to North Korea, no bilateral talks with North Korea. Ultimately, in fact, those bilateral talks did take place. And in fact, there has been real diplomatic progress in persuading North Korea to shut down some of its nuclear facilities. And it looks like Secretary of State Rice has looked at this pattern and said, maybe we can apply it to Iran. There are a lot of differences. It might not be as simple, and it wasn't simple within the North Korea case.
One other blip here on the diplomatic circuit. There's word that Washington might open an interest section, not an embassy, but an interest section in Tehran.
In fact, it looks like the Bush administration has discussed this seriously. There already is an interest section in the Swiss embassy. The Swiss embassy in Tehran represents U.S. interests, but not much goes on there. The Iranians have a much more active interest section in the Pakistan embassy in Washington. And this apparently also, at the initiative of Secretary of State Rice, has been floated through the administration for the last few months. And in the last couple of weeks, they seem closer and closer to making an actual decision about this. But it doesn't look like they have, or if they have, they're not sure about how to implement it.
I've asked you several times in conversations we've had on the show in recent months about, imagine a doomsday clock ticking down to war with Iran. Yeah. And each time you've said, it's less likely, it's less likely. There's a alarming piece in the op-ed page of the New York Times today from Israeli historian Benny Morris predicting a conventional war with Iran in the next few months and saying it could easily lead to nuclear war before the end of the Bush administration.
One of the most hysterical things that I've read about Iran ever, certainly in the last year, To my mind, it seems less and less likely that there'll be any kind of military attack against Iran, as we see here and there, incrementally, a case building for diplomatic engagement between the United States and Iran. And it seems that those who urge military action within the Bush administration seem to be accepting the fact that in this election year, the results of an attack would be so unpredictable vis-a-vis the presidential election that it would be that it's almost entirely out of question.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster. Mike, thank you again.
You're welcome.
Back now with Day to Day, I'm Alex Chadwick. Oil prices did something this week that we haven't seen much of lately. They fell 3 days in a row. Analysts say falling demand could bring energy costs down significantly in the coming months. Marketplace's Amy Scott is with us. Amy, why are oil prices down this week?
Well, Alex, analysts are chalking it up to concerns about the economy. You know, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke was on Capitol Hill this week talking about significant challenges facing the U.S. economy. Even China's economy grew at its slowest pace in 3 years in the second quarter. I talked with the chief investment strategist at Wachovia Securities, Bill O'Grady, and he says the markets seemed to realize this week that commodity prices won't keep going up forever.
It's almost like kind of a light bulb type realization that a global slowdown is going to reduce demand for commodities across the board, which has led to a significant sell-off in oil.
Of course, today, news that Nigeria had cut back on production reversed that sell-off a bit. But analysts do expect this decline in demand to have a real effect on prices.
You know, it's clear that U.S. consumers are starting to change their behavior because of the cost of gasoline. Do you see demand falling in other parts of the world?
Right. U.S. drivers have really responded to these higher gas prices. Gasoline consumption is down about 5% compared to last year, and this is peak driving season. But fuel subsidies continue to really help prop up demand in parts of Asia and the Middle East. The International Energy Agency predicts that global demand will still rise by 1% next year. But because of that pressure from the U.S. and European economies, some analysts I've talked to say we might see oil fall as low as $100 a barrel in the coming months.
Would that this kind of regenerate the whole price cycle again?
Right. Well, $100 oil is still pretty expensive. A year ago, it was about $75 a barrel. So I'm told that even that much of a decline probably isn't enough to reverse the shift in consumption we've been seeing.
Well, if oil prices do continue to fall, when do you think we would see a real drop in gasoline prices? Because I haven't seen that at the pump yet.
Right. Today, the national average is down by not quite a penny, according to AAA. So, you know, it's a start. But one analyst I talked to said we could see a 10-cent drop or more fairly soon. So if crude oil prices do stay down, the difference at the pump will be noticeable and maybe not too late for that summer road trip.
Thank you, Amy. Amy Scott of Public Radio's Daily Business Show, Marketplace. Okay, Petro Guzzlers, you've learned your lesson, haven't you? You're ready to buy a Prius. Sorry, too late. They're all gone. A Toyota dealer in Manassas, Virginia is so desperate, it's offering a deal for customers who bought Priuses over the last few years. The dealer will buy them back at the sales price, no questions asked. So, if you cannot get a hybrid to buy, how about looking for a cheaper fuel? A lot of people are doing that. A recent Associated Press story described motorists in the Gaza Strip trying to make fuel with everything from cooking oil to pesticides and air fresheners. We're not quite that desperate yet, but people are getting creative. Here's NPR's Allison Keyes.
Some folk are willing to sacrifice a lot for things that are important to them. James Barenschmidt of Severna Park, Maryland, is one of them.
When I'm going to brew my biodiesel, I first fill up the tank with used veggie oil and then I just started heating up.
Watching Barenschmidt's process, it's clear that making one's own fuel is not for the impatient or the faint-hearted. He begins with a 30-gallon vat of used oil that he gets from a nearby Chinese food restaurant. Then
we'll do the titration where you basically tests the level of acidity of the used veggie oil, and then based on the level of acidity, that determines how much potassium hydroxide you mix in with the methanol before you then in turn mix that in with the heated up used veggie oil.
Oh, it looks like coconut.
Yeah, but don't try to taste it. Now keep in mind, it is a poison. You can get a little bit of it on your skin, but if you leave it on your skin long enough, it starts eating away at it.
Barenschmidt didn't do anything special to his car, except add a computer chip that increases his engine power. But other drivers are doing more drastic things to their automobiles, and a Los Angeles-based company called Lovecraft Biofuels is helping them. Owner Tacy Webb explains that they've converted close to 2,200 diesel engines to run on other types of fuel, including 100% vegetable oil.
Our system is a one-tank system. It utilizes the existing fuel tank, so you can put biodiesel, diesel, vegetable oil, including used vegetable oil, all in the same tank.
Webb says her company already has bustling offices in L.A. and Portland, and the skyrocketing gas prices have business booming at such a rate that they plan on opening stores in Austin, Texas, and in San Francisco by the end of this year. Their conversion kits run from $500 for a do-it-yourself to about $1,000 if the company does it for you. Webb says customers can both save money and do something for the environment.
It really puts fuel independence in the hands of the people, pump by pump, like each time that you fuel up, you're making a choice of which fuel you use.
But you don't have to drive a diesel to cash in on some of the new technology out there. The California-based E-Fuel Corporation plans to start shipments of a $10,000 home ethanol system by the end of this year. The company's vice president of biofuels, Floyd Butterfield, says the E-Fuel 100 microfueler is about the size of a stackable washer dryer.
You put in feedstock in the machine, close the lid, press a button, and in a couple days, alcohol will start being accumulated in the tank. You just take a hose like your regular hose at the gas station and fill your car.
Butterfield says depending on the price of sugar, it could cost as little as $1 a gallon to make ethanol. The microfueler can also run on leftover alcohol like beer, which can be turned into ethanol, and that would cost just 10 to 25 cents a gallon. But critics question whether the alternative fuels actually save consumers money. Experts say the fuels might damage your car, and there are legal issues as well. One needs a federal permit to brew ethanol at home, and the EPA says it's illegal to run cars on 100% ethanol or 100% vegetable oil. In fact, a company that modifies vehicles to run on vegetable oil faces a maximum fine of $32,500 per violation. The maximum fine for an individual who does so is $2,750. State laws vary. In Maryland, where James Barenschmidt mixes his fuel, drivers using vegetable oil face a fine if they don't register with the state and fail to file monthly payments. He says he'll register, but he says he hopes an increasing outcry from people who are taking their fuel production into their own hands goads the government into changing its standards.
Sometimes, I mean, that's what you really need to bring about change.
Then there'd be more people like Barenschmidt, who basically don't go to gas stations at all, except to fill up their tires. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, one more. Daydreaming, that's our blog. Senior producer Stephen Prophet writes about his new obsession, which is riding the rails. We think he means the subway in Washington, D.C. Check it out at our blog, npr.org/daydreaming. While you're there, tell us your stories about public transportation dreams and nightmares. npr.org/daydreaming. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick. Okay, you petro-guzzling, planet-heating wastrels tooling along out there at 15 miles a gallon, grit your teeth for a moment. Get ready for another NPR piece on how to be a better person. Actually, there's a gathering of better persons this weekend in Madison, Wisconsin, and you are not invited. This is for hybrid owners. It's called Hybrid Fest. You won't be there, but the Fonz family will. Here's Chuck Kornbeck of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Meet the Fonz family of Pewaukee. If there was a first family of hybrid car owners in Wisconsin, they'd be it. Bradley and Marie Fonz and their 19-year-old son, Justin, are all passionate about driving gas-electric hybrids. They want to help others who spend the extra money to buy one of these vehicles. So the family offers hints on squeezing more miles out of a gallon of gas. go for a ride in Marie's 2004 Toyota Prius, and she'll soon be telling you about a driving method called the Pulse and Glide.
I'm gliding right now. I started off and I got to a momentum where the car was running efficiently, and then I just took my foot off the gas, and we're in a glide right now where the engine is at peak efficiency. It's not using any gasoline to run.
Husband Bradley drives a 2000 Honda Insight. It averages about 66 miles per gallon, but that's not good enough for him. Bradley says he always looks for ways to do even better. While I was riding with him in a residential area, he suddenly turned the engine off and eased down a hill.
Which, in this vehicle, is safe to do. In other vehicles, it's not recommended. Basically, I just turned the car off, and right now I'm coasting, and I'm getting 96 miles per gallon.
To finish out the hybrid tour with the Fons family, I then hopped into Justin's 2004 Honda Insight. He's just as much of an advocate as his parents. Justin says he doesn't mind occasionally being teased by his peers about his passion for fuel efficiency. He says he thinks they'll catch up.
I think some of the younger people haven't quite grasped, you know, what they can do to solve the problem yet, but they're more open to it, and that's a big plus in trying to get more people informed.
Justin is a political science major in college and dreams of working in politics to create incentives for Americans to buy green. And he agrees with one of this weekend's Hybrid Fest speakers, Felix Kramer, who talks about plug-in models being the next big thing. Kramer heads the California Cars Initiative and says plug-ins recharge on electricity and don't use gasoline.
Electricity comes from domestic sources. We don't use imported oil to make electricity. So you get the energy security benefit. So this switch, it's not just about using less gasoline. It's about using cleaner, cheaper domestic electricity.
Back in his driveway in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, Bradley Fons says he hopes to eventually own a plug-in hybrid. But he says the reality for many years is that most vehicles will have traditional gasoline engines. That means change is up to the driver.
Every time you turn the key in your car, you can save yourself money if you change your attitude and say, this is what I'm going to do.
So Fons also likes to offer advice that a driver of any vehicle could use. Plan your route, properly inflate your tires, accelerate slowly, and numerous other tips that people ignored when gas was $1.50 a gallon. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach.
Back now with Day to Day, You Know Who swings into movie theaters today. Should you go see The Batman? Here is Mark Jordan Ligon with Slate's Summary Judgment.
Superhero movies just keep coming. But the highly anticipated Christopher Nolan follow-up to his 2005 Batman Begins was also earmarked because of the tragic death of one of the lead actors, Heath Ledger. The Dark Knight continues to follow the brooding Batman as he tries to protect Gotham City from a new evil mastermind called the Joker.
Why don't we cut you up into little pieces and feed you to your pooches? And then we'll see how loyal a hungry dog really is.
The Dark Knight is one of the best-reviewed films of the year. Variety raves, enthralling, brainy pop entertainment that satisfies every expectation raised by its hit predecessor and then some. The Chicago Tribune calls it sensational and grandly sinister, and the New York Daily News Review, twisted, tortured, terrifying, and terrific, is obviously brought to you today by the letter T. But maybe The Dark Knight is just too, well, dark, and you want some lighter fare, something to take the kids to. Say, oh, maybe a computer-animated comedy about chimpanzees in outer space. Well, faster than you can toss a banana in a wormhole, here's Space Chimps. The title says it all.
Commander's log. Space, the final frontier.
Permission to speak, Commander?
Permission granted.
You're a dork.
No need for name-calling, but even the critics find the movie a bit dorky. Yes, I know I am also name-calling, but they started it! Even though the Chicago Sun-Times finds it delightful from beginning to end, the majority of reviews agree with USA Today, which warns only a truly dreadful story could make 81 minutes seem like an eternity, and Space Chimps is just that leaden experience. Great. Now I'll never be able to sell my animal adventure, Deep Sea Poodles. And for true escapism this weekend, how about the film adaptation of the smash Broadway musical Mamma Mia, with wall-to-wall ABBA songs being sung by everyone from Pierce Brosnan to Colin Firth to Meryl Streep.
Feel the beat from the tambourine.
Yes, well, the critics are as split on the movie as most people are about ABBA. They either love it or hate it. The Hollywood Reporter cheers a delightful piece of filmmaking with a marvelous cast. The Philadelphia Inquirer shrugs, by turns entertaining and excruciating, but the Village Voice growls, little more than droopy ditties draped around a threadbare plot. So, wow, multiple Oscar winner Meryl Streep singing ABBA tunes. Is there anything else like this? Oh, yes, there was the ill-fated project where the late, great Laurence Olivier gave dramatic readings to the songs of John Cougar Mellencamp. Sucking on a chili dog outside the tasty freeze. Diane sitting on Jackie's lap. He's got his hand between her knees. Cut! All right, what is this?
Mark Jordan Ligon is a writer living in Los Angeles. In New York, a new city law is requiring chain restaurants to post the calorie counts of all their menu items. If you don't do it by midnight tonight, you can get fined. NPR's Robert Smith went out this morning to see how New Yorkers are dealing with the new caloric reality.
It's hard enough standing in line at Starbucks in the morning. You're bleary-eyed. The line is long here in New York City. But now at least there's something you can do while you're waiting. You can look at all of the different calorie counts, and you can even play the calorie count game. I'm here with Chantel Henry from Brooklyn.
Yes.
What do you think has more calories, the banana nut loaf or the rainbow cookie?
Banana.
The banana nut loaf actually does have 460 calories, and the rainbow cookie 420 calories.
Mm-hmm.
Does this change the way you shop? Does this change what you buy at Starbucks every morning?
Yes. I just will cut down a little, because I usually have Starbucks every day.
She looks so bummed out that I don't point out that her caramel frappuccino is 380 calories. So I go across the street to McDonald's, and I run into a very trim...
Ronnie Hansen from Bergenfield, New Jersey.
You're here in McDonald's. What did you have for breakfast?
Oh, yeah. What did I have? A McMuffin.
Now, the surprising thing when you actually see the McDonald's menu is that the Egg McMuffin, which is the symbol of terrible fast food morning breakfast, is in fact
the least amount. I noticed that.
It is the lowest calorie thing on the menu.
I know, because I was going to get the burritos, and they were higher, and I said, I'm going to go with the Egg McMuffin.
So already this is changing your behavior. On just the first day they're doing this, it's changing your behavior.
Sure. Definitely. I'm definitely looking to make sure I don't put on extra weight.
Come on. On your birthday, do you want someone to serve you a slice of birthday cake and say, oh, by the way, happy birthday, it's 782 calories?
No, but if you don't want to know, you don't have to look.
That is the strategy employed by Lonnie General sitting at the next table. He's eating...
steak, egg, and cheese breakfast meal.
Did you even look at how many calories that is up there?
Nope. Don't care.
Well, luckily I wrote it down. That's 660 calories. That's one of the highest calorie items on the entire menu.
Well, I'll take a bite out of that.
Is it delicious? Is it sinfully delicious?
Yes, it is. The government needs to mind its own damn business. Let people live their life the way they want to live their life. In a nutshell.
For those New Yorkers who don't want a shot of nutritional reality in the morning, there is an alternative, a loophole in the law. You see, it only applies to chain restaurants. If you're a mom-and-pop independent store, you do not have to post the calorie counts. So you can do what I did this morning, which was, when the line at Starbucks was too long, I went over to my local coffee cart. I'd like a regular cup of coffee, cream and sugar, and a raisin bran muffin. Do you know how many calories are in that bran muffin?
I don't know.
You don't know? So I should just eat it and be happy?
Yeah. Yeah, just like take the donuts, I'm going to be happy.
I guess it's truly a guilt-free breakfast. Robert Smith, NPR News in Times Square.